There are times in the history of this planet in which God calls special agents and he equips these special ones with an assignment to do what only others can dream of doing. That fits the description of my guest today, Carlisle Holder, and I want to welcome you to the show today, Carlisle.
Hey, good morning, and I want to say hello, and I'm so excited to be part of this show.
You are fantastic, man. You know, I'm going to tell you something, brother. I'm in love with talent and creativity, and I say that because you happen to be one of those very talented and creative persons, and I'm not trying to grease you or pump you up. But that's the reality of it all. You have that special something, that X factor. And I'm glad to have you on the show today, Carlisle.
Well, Pastor Holt, I'm honored that you will even consider me to be a participant on the radio show.
God bless you.
The feelings are mutual.
That's beautiful. Carlisle was born in Trinidad, and he migrated to the United States when he was 17 years old. Your career spans over 40 years in the criminal justice system, 27 years with the United States Department of Justice. You served 23 years, or shall I say 23 of those years, as a supervisor, manager, and an executive. You were also chief executive officer for 12 years, managing the largest correctional complex facilities in the Bureau of Prisons, and you served as a warden in those facilities. You attended Allen Hancock College and New York University, where you majored in criminal justice. You founded an organization, President of Correctional Management and Communications Group, back in the year 2008, of which you now continue to serve. You're married to Josephine, and you have six lovely children living in Claremont, Florida. And Carlisle, what can I say, man? When I read over your bio, I had to scratch my head. I had to try to pull out some hair that I don't have. I was just so, you know, impressed with the way God has used you over the years. Now, we're gonna get started, man. And what I wanna do initially, I want you to give me our listening audience, give us a quick overview of your life. It doesn't have to be anything in detail, but I gave kind of a methodical overview of some of the things that you did in life up until now. But to hear it from you, where you will put emphasis in areas where you feel emphasis needs to be placed, and give some of the highlights of where you feel you've made the greatest contributions. Now, I'm going to jump in. I'm going to jump in at you know, prescribed times, but I do want to hear the narrative, the story coming from you in terms of some of the things that you have been able to accomplish, most fulfilling things, the most critical areas. And let's begin that, Carlisle. So I'm going to throw it back into your hands, and you go ahead and start talking to us about your life.
You know, I think life, I always like to refer life as a beginning, a dash in between, and an end. And I think that I would like to start with my childhood, because I think it's important that we put into context the importance of your childhood upbringing.
Yeah.
That may frame, you know, your life for many, many years. I was born in Trinidad. My dad left when I was 6 months old to go to school in England, and didn't meet my biological dad till I was 14. I was fortunate to have a great stepdad who was a member of the police service and then the Coast Guard there in Trinidad, and created a great foundation in terms of, you know, providing for the family. So I grew up, you know, in a family atmosphere that I helped frame who I am today.
Yeah, let's pause there for 1 second, Carlisle, because What you're mentioning right now is critical because everybody who we are today, the foundationally become that, you know, when we were children. What was your family like? I mean, your brothers and sisters, what was the culture in your home? And who were the greatest influencers in your home? So I've asked several questions there. What kind of culture did you grow up in? Was it a toxic culture? Was it an empowering culture? And what was the culture like with your parents who were there and your siblings?
Well, I'm the only boy at that time. I had three sisters. I currently have four now. I would say that we was raised in a spiritual home. I actually grew up being a Catholic and went and had my first communion and confirmation. And then during the week, I went to church with my grandmother, who was Baptist. So I think that's important, you know, that I had a strong spiritual upbringing as a child. Okay. So I would say that while I recognize that no home is perfect, because you know, me and my mom was real close, and I saw some things that was imperfect. Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that we live in an imperfect world, but we strive to be perfect. Well, but I don't think we'll ever get there. So I don't want to give the appearance that my life was so plumb. You know, I recognize that there was some social dynamics as a kid, you know, in the home, but it didn't frame. It wasn't a toxic environment, but nevertheless, it was, you know, there were some issues that I saw growing up because I was close to my mom.
Now, you didn't recognize them as issues at that time, did you? Or did you recognize them as issues as you got back and you started got older and started reflecting?
I reflect older more than back then when I was a kid. You know, I saw the things, but it didn't really trigger me to worry about it or to be concerned or to ask questions about it.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
As I reflect as adult, I can see how some of these things can bleed over into your own life.
Yeah,
right.
That's good.
Right. Because it the seed was planted then as a child.
Yeah, that's great. I love it, man. I just want to, you know, move on. That's beautiful. That foundation is very, very significant, and the ability to know what went on during that time and be able to make some sense out of it. Now, when you moved to the United States when you were 17 years old, what motivated you to go into the Marine Corps? What was your motivation?
Well, if you can allow me to just, you know, cover one last aspect, because I think it's important to let the audience hear this short story, because I believe sometimes we focus more on the accomplishment, but we focus on trials and the tribute. So when I was 12 years old, my mom decided she was going to leave and come to the U.S. To hopefully create a better life for us. At the time, as a young person, as a 12-year-old, you don't understand those types of dynamics. And my mom left in September. My grandmother died in February the following year. And I begin to rebel because I saw my life was crumbling around me. The people that I care most wasn't there.
Wow.
So I started to act out in school and ended up quitting school and running away from home. Mm. You know, period. Not that I was a bad kid. I just my world was falling apart and I couldn't understand it. And I say that because, you know, I tell folks today that, you know, sometimes we jump to conclusions when we see young people acting out, and mm-hmm. we never take the time to find out why. And I use my example because, you know, of the experience that I had. I'm grateful you know, I lived in the streets in Port of Spain for a couple of months, and I'm grateful for the fact that the world was totally different back then than it is now. And I was able to survive, and then my mom, you know, sent for us, and she brought us to the U.S. at 17, which will now, you know, that's where you wanted to take off to, right? But I wanted to make sure that life wasn't always this rosy,
yeah,
you know, and I wanted to say that too. As I was leaving, I was told by my aunt that I would never be anything, and that also stuck with me, and I always used that as a motivation and not a crutch, right? Yeah, I always felt like I'm gonna prove them wrong. And that's how my whole life then transcends as I came to the U.S.
Now, is that aunt still alive?
No, she isn't.
Okay. Okay. Did she see any of the successes that you've been able to achieve? Did she live long enough?
Yes. And it wasn't an aunt by blood. It was an aunt that my mother's brother's ex-wife. So,
okay.
So I want to make that clear as well. We just call it, you know, aunt, you know, as you know, for respect.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. So the military now, you came to the United States. What was the motivating factor to go into military, the Marine Corps?
Well, I came to the U.S. on April the 15th, and my intention was to go to college. My dad was getting his PhD at Columbia University, and I, you know, during that process, my stepdad, He took me to learn to play the steel drums in Brooklyn, and I had a unique experience that my steel orchestra was selected to be the opening act for Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones World Tour of 1975. So I find myself for 5 nights performing at Madison Square Garden.
Wow.
In New York City for that tour. That was in May. I met this young man that we was renting from his dad. We was renting from his dad. He was joining the Marines, and I watched. We talked about it. Saw the uniform. I had some experience, paramilitary experience when I was back in Trinidad, like the ROTC, I was part of the ROTC in Trinidad. So I did have some familiarity with military. And then my stepdad there was also in the Coast Guard, an officer Coast Guard. So I decided at that time, you know what, I told my mom, I said, you know, I think I want to join the Marines. And, I wanted to get into electronics. When I mentioned it to my dad, my biological dad, he obviously was opposed of it. So I tell my mom, you know, I needed someone to sign for me to go in at 17. And I tell my mom, you know, well, my dad wasn't in my life, you know, for all these years. And I don't think, you know, he had the authority to determine what my life was going to be. And my mom agreed, and I decided, and that's when I signed up and went into the United States Marines.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing, man. You know what, I guess I can spend a lot of time also with your sharing with me, you know, and us, what your experience in the Marine Corps, but indeed we have to get on to some of the other areas, and I don't want to, you know, expend a lot of time. You know, the foundational part of it is very, very critical, and I'm glad that you're sharing that. Now, after you left the Marine Corps, you did do a stint in a school, and you majored in criminal justice. Am I right?
Yes, yes. Well, I always understand the value of education, right? But so every opportunity while in the Marines, I got to go to school. I did so. I did so when I went on a Navy ship for 6 months. I took courses through Old Dominion University and actually got my associate's degree prior to my discharge from the Marines after 4 years. You know, fortunate, in the Marines, I came in second in boot camp, first in school. I was a sergeant, E5, at 19 years old.
Wow.
I was fortunate to do well. I played for the All-Marine soccer team, and trained with Leon Spinks, who was on the All-Marine boxing team and ended up winning. I think he beat Muhammad Ali to win the title.
Uh-huh.
So I had a great time. My 4 years in the Marines was memorable and really kind of laid the foundation in terms of being disciplined. And I guess it transferred as I went and I decided to pursue a career in the criminal justice field.
Wow. It's amazing how little, you know, unknown steps. We don't realize, you know, how important certain decisions that we make will ultimately have in where we end up in life. So your going into the Marine Corps definitely was a shaping and fashioning of your character and personality, preparing you for the days ahead.
Yes, I would strongly say so, because, you know, a lot of times as young people, we don't really know where our life journey will take us.
That's right. We certainly don't.
And sometimes we experiment and sometimes we fail and sometimes we succeed, because I can tell you I had no desire or had any prior experience when I decided to become a correctional officer. My leaning was more in the law enforcement side. I wanted to be a cop in New York City, work for NYPD. And my mom wasn't too excited about that. And then I was going to be a police officer, a federal police officer at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And then the prison called, and the police officer was a GS-4, the correctional officer was a GS-6. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to give it a shot and pack my bags and moved all the way to California to start my career in corrections, from Brooklyn, New York, to the federal penitentiary in Long Park, California.
Wow. Now, let me ask you, man, and I want us to get on into the rise from a correctional officer to a warden. But your experience as a correctional officer, tell me just briefly what that was like. Now, we hear the horror stories up here in the New York area about correction officers and them working in the system. What was your experience like working in the system as a correctional officer?
I think it's appropriate to put it in the right context. You know, I started in 1980, and at that time, there was only about 30,000 federal prisoners and about 30 federal prisons. And I started at a penitentiary. So I was so young because at that time, you know, men that are serving time in a penitentiary would have worked their way up through. So your resident population was normally much older. Older men, and I remember they used to joke at me, because, you know, I was a skinny 180 pound, just got out of the Marine fit, I didn't even used to shave at the time. And I remember they would say, boy, what you doing here, you know? I just did my job. I just, you know, there was some difficulty dealing with the staff. You know, there was some racism. There was only nine black officers at the facility at the time, and we had to induce some racism, but it didn't hinder you know, at least it didn't impact me that it derailed or I got caught up in it. So I served as a correctional officer for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great experience, you know, dealing with the men, that was on the, that I had the opportunity to supervise. And I learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, you know, my thing is this: you treat people the way you wanted to be treated and within the rules and regulations, and then everything will be okay. I think, you know, and that's the one thing I learned, you know,
yeah.
They may not always agree with you,
mm-hmm.
but if you do it by the rules, they may get mad, but they'll get over.
Yeah.
And that's what I try to do.
That's great. Now, you know what, you mentioned something on yesterday. We had the privilege, and I say we, myself and a few other individuals had the privilege of being on a kind of a discussion group on yesterday, and Brother Carlisle was a part of that, and he was able to bring us all behind the veil to see a lot of things that we don't ordinarily see as civilians, or shall I say citizens. So that was very, very eye-opening for me. Now, one of the things you mentioned, and I want you to briefly go through this because it really, really meant a lot to me, when you said that you came up the ranks from being a correction officer in the system to becoming a warden. Now, that journey must have been, you know, something, and I just want to hear you briefly tell us how you came up the ranks from a correction officer with an associate's degree all the way to the area of being a warden of some of the most renowned prison systems in the country.
Well, I have to admit that I had no ambition or desire to be a warden when I started. I just wanted a good government job that can provide for me. I actually, after being a correctional officer, I transferred back to the Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York City as a legal technician, and then worked my way up there to be the manager of that department. And that's when I really decided that maybe there's an opportunity that I can move up the ranks.
Now, when you said in New York, you served in what department?
I served in the receiving and discharge department.
Okay.
So when folks are arrested and they come in and they get processed in, you fingerprint and you do all the booking stuff. And
yeah.
I initially, you know, came in as a line staff, and then a year later I was promoted to supervisor. Yeah. And I think a year later I was promoted to the manager of that department, and at the time it was the most active receiving and discharge department in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. That's right in the middle of the great explosion in the 80s of the federal, you know, prison system, as well as state systems around the country.
Okay.
As you know, started with the 1984, you know, Crime Prevention Act.
Mm-hmm.
Which started the increase in the prison population in the federal and states.
Okay. So from there, what opportunities availed themselves for the beginning of the climb?
So I felt like at the time I had some close calls while in Manhattan, not as a result of my behavior, but as a result of my staff, because we were moving a lot of people. A lot of people was coming in, and, you know, we was transferring them, and I spent a lot of time working. You know, there were nights I didn't come home. My mom would just, you know, bring me a change of clothes. And I felt like, you know, at the time there was a position that opened up for the first time in the Bureau as an EEO investigator, full-time EEO investigator. And it was located in the regional office in Philadelphia. And I decided, well, you know what? I'm gonna put my name in the hat. And I got selected.
Mm.
Uh, for that job. And my warden at the time actually called me in and offered me the same grade for that position so I can stay in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And I think the greatest decision I made was to transfer. I went from Philadelphia. I hated that job. I only did it for 1 year because I felt like there was the backlogs of EEO investigations, and I felt like people didn't take my role seriously. They look at you as a villain, versus as a fact finder.
Yeah.
I did that job for 1 year and 1 day, and it was a pilot program, so my superiors wasn't too fond of me wanting to leave in the first year. They felt like I needed to stay longer, and thank God I didn't. I transferred to become the regional affirmative action administrator for the northeast part of the United States, and also the national Black Affairs Program Manager, responsible for the recruitment of African Americans in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. I did that for about a year, almost 2 years, and then I decided I would transfer to become the executive assistant to a warden that was activating a new facility in Texas.
Wow.
And that was my first, you know, hooray into the executive ranks of the prison services. You know, you have the executive assistant, and then you go to, you know, the assistant warden, and then you go to warden. So at that time, I realized that maybe, you know, I can see myself, you know, wanting to become a warden. So I transferred to Texas, and then transfer to Louisiana as assistant warden, back to Texas as assistant warden, and then I was promoted warden. At the time, I was the youngest warden to be promoted. I was 38 years old.
Wow. Wow. And was that the Air Force?
Yeah, that was the federal prison camp they used to call it Club Fed. At the Eglin Air Force Base in Florida.
Okay, okay. Now, why was it there? It wasn't just for military people, was it? Was it a prison just
for... No. It wasn't for military people. What we did back then, they used to have prisons on the military base. We'll help with the upkeep of the base, the cutting of the grass and doing all the stuff. So there wasn't a military prison per se. It was just on a military base.
Yeah. Listen, man, I tell you, you know, as I read your bio, of course you had some real, real prestigious positions in some of the most, you know, well acclaimed systems in the country. Tell me again, because we're racing against time, I don't like to continue to bring that up, but I just want to make sure that I get to some issues that I feel the audience needs to know. Tell me some of the most fulfilling areas of your life in the system, the most fulfilling across the board of all of the institutions that you served. What were some of the most fulfilling?
I would give reference to two areas that really kind of transform my transgression in the system. First is when I decided to move to Three Rivers, Texas. I was the first Black person that they saw in that city. In fact, they would actually stop and look like I was an alien or something. That's how bad it was. But that turned out to be one of the most fulfilling experience. I was able to recruit a lot of African Americans to the area, and my warden at the time was, I give him so much credit. I remember one time we went to a meeting and at the country club, and they said I couldn't come in and sit, although the people that was cleaning and cooking the food were African American. they said I couldn't come in and sit with him. And he said, well, if he can't come in, then I can't speak. And that, God bless his soul, that gentleman, you know, he fought for me. I know that they wanted me to go back to the training academy to be the assistant director. And it wasn't a promotion in grade, although the title of the position may sound good. And he told them, nah, he's going to just stay here. And the next thing I know, that I was promoted to assistant warden. So had he not fight for me and I had went to the training academy, I don't know where my career would have went.
Yeah, you sound like Joseph, man, you know. And when I say you sound like Joseph, man, in the Bible, brother, had all of these uneventualities in his life, man. One thing led to another thing. No clue, but man, it was all God's way of getting him from that pit to the house of the king, boy, I tell you the truth. So yeah, you know, very, very exciting story you have here, man. So that was one of the most fulfilling areas.
Then the next one was the opportunity to come back home to Brooklyn.
Okay.
To be the warden at that facility and to activate the largest, you know, pretrial facility in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. The Metropolitan Detention Center, and I volunteered for that assignment on the aftermath. There was a big story called the Bad Fellas, that the story was that the mob had taken over the prison, and I was sent there on assignment, and it was such a rewarding assignment, you know, because the brown and black staff there was being unfairly, right, labeled as not being professional, and they just came and did everything I asked of them and supported me in everything that I did in the city. You know, we used to go out and we participate in the parades and stuff. We had the inmates cleaning up the neighborhoods and getting rid of graffiti. And that's the location as well that I was promoted to the senior executive service in the federal government. That's the highest one can attain in federal services, the senior executive service. So I was appointed to that while I was the warden at Brooklyn at the age of 42. Mm. And so for me, you know, that was a significant accomplishment because of the 1.8 federal employees. I think there was only about 4,000 individuals that served in that rank. So I competed and was selected, and it's a pretty tedious and competitive process. Mm. So there was really two things. The fact that I can come back home and lead the people from my city and to show the Bureau of Prisons that the people that being portrayed is not the people that actually work there. Mm-hmm. And we proved it and turned that facility around. Mm. So that's one of a great accomplishments for me. Not personally and professionally.
That's amazing, man. Hey, that's amazing. Tell me three of the most pivotal people in your life, Carlisle.
Well, I would have to say my mom. My mom is one, my mentor. Her name is Margaret Harden, who worked for the Bureau of Prisons. And then I had my superior, Bob Matthews, who gave me the opportunity to become a warden under his tutelage and leadership, and then provided, you know, many opportunities for me to grow in the Bureau of Prisons.
That's amazing. That's fantastic. Great, man. Now, is your mom still alive?
Yes, my mom is still alive. She lives in Brooklyn, New York, and wow. She'll be 87 this year, so I'll be up spending some time with September.
Yeah, that's good, man. Good, man. What give me two of the most critical choices you've had to make. No, no, I'm asking this off the cuff.
Yeah, I think
We'll come back to that. What about two of the most defining moments, aha moment, the two of the most defining moments?
I think when I married my wife, and you know, I was up in age. I was 38, and wasn't sure if I can have kids at the time. I had two kids out of wedlock. I just wanted to have kids where I can, you know, I can raise them in a family atmosphere. And my wife was told that she couldn't have any kids, or if she did, she can die, because she had a tuber pregnancy. And she took, you know, she decided she was willing to risk, you know, her life in order to fill my life.
Lord have mercy.
And you know, we end up having two kids together. And she had two kids, and I had two kids, so we had six kids together, and now we have 13 grandkids.
Wow, that's
I
amazing.
think that was a defining moment. And I think the next one I would say is the fact that I decided to retire at my first eligibility, right? I was eligible to retire at 50, and I didn't work one day past 50, although I could have worked 7 more years. My kids was 11 and 10 when I decided to retire. And most people always make the excuse, oh, I can't retire, I got kids in school, you know, I still gotta work. And I made that decision, and I stuck by it, and it was the best thing that I did, because I was able to spend time with my kids in their most formable years, at teenagers, and traveling with them, you know, playing basket, watching them play basketball. And my baby boy is now a pastor. So we I glad I made the decision then and wouldn't change a thing.
There you go, Doc. There you go. It's fantastic, man. Yeah, listen, man, you authored a book. The book entitled Can Any Good Thing Come Out of Prison? Two things I want you to address. Number one, why did you write the book? And number two, who was the audience for which the book was written?
I think sometimes we have defining moments in our life that needs to be documented. And I felt that my experience at the Federal Correctional Complex in Coleman was one of those moments that I woke up and I felt like God was speaking to me that I needed to do more for the men and women under my tutelage. And I answered the call, and as such, I always tell folks that what I thought was my job, it became my ministry. Opportunity to pour into men and women so that they can see that they are more valued than what a system or what a sentence or what a judge may say they are. And I begin to pour into them, the residents that was under my care, through a lot of programming and grounded on a spiritual foundation, you know. So I would have my family there. We'll all be praying, and the men will be just, you know, reaching out. And it was a defining moment, and I felt like that experience need to be captured, because what we normally hear about what happens in prison is not what we experienced during that time. So, you know, we didn't have any homicides. You know, the men and women were responsive to the programs, and it was based on mutual respect. So I said the book, you know, and I wanted the world to know that as well, that people make bad choices, they're not necessarily bad people. And so that's why the title of my book, Can Any Good Thing Come Out of Prison, is based on John 1:4-6, Can Any Good Thing Come Out of Nazareth? So it was a subliminal message to let the world know that the men and women that are behind these bad wires are not necessarily all bad people. Yes, there are some bad people, but what I found out is that the majority of them is a result of their childhood, their experiences, what they have grown up, and they made bad choices. And I saw a lot of them just wanted to be led in a different direction.
Yeah.
And they followed me, and I was grateful for that.
That is so good, man. You know, your book, I didn't get a chance to read it all, but I did see some of it, and I packed it away when I moved, so I didn't have my hands on it for this interview. But I was impressed by the concept, you know. Now, when you go around to speak for other institutions, do you share your experience in terms of how you treated these prisoners and how you changed the culture there? Do you share that with other institutions?
Yes, I and Pastor, you know, I wrote the book more so as an educational tool. I have chosen not to. I've been invited to speak a lot, and I haven't really done so. The book is in a couple of universities as an elective for criminal justice professionals. I do get to speak at a couple universities, and I share my experience, because as you know, that until you work in it, we all, the perception and the reality of what we learn that happens in prisons is not really what happens, right? We that, you know, these movies, and we think that's how it works. But, you know, I tell folks, these are real men and women, mothers and daughters and grandmothers and grandfathers, right? The society is putting them in our care so they can be rehabilitated and become productive citizens upon return. And in reality, the system fails them the majority of the time.
Yes,
right?
It does, man. It does. It does. You know, your attitude and your outlook is extremely refreshing. You know, it's transformative, to say the least. And I thank the Lord for the way you approach and have approached what you do in your mindset on that. And I think that's all God-given. And when I mentioned at the beginning in my introduction that God assigns individuals with a special assignment that many could only dream of, it was with this, what you're doing right now, is what motivated that statement in that introduction in introducing you today. I'm very proud of you, man. I love your creativity, because creativity is a gift from God, and your ability to go in there and take what I'm sure others were not able to do, you were able to transform that institution and for the betterment of those people. And I understand that you're now having many of those people that were under your tutelage, as you mentioned, in a follow-up program that you have, or in an annual program that you have. Tell us a little bit about that before we sign out.
Yeah, it's I started a nonprofit called Carlisle Holder Ministries to serve, you know, returning citizens and formerly incarcerated individuals. And what I started is an annual reunion, because somehow the folks that once they left prison, they connected to me.
Yeah.
So I think the first reunion we had was in 2018, and we had almost 200 individuals and their family members. And I actually bring them to my city, and all they have to do is come. I take care of all the other costs associated with that. And then we do a picnic. We let them share their stories, their progress or lack of their. I offer some programming for them, and then we have a restoration service before everybody leaves and go back. And then we had a break, you know, because of the pandemic, and we did it. We had it this year in April. And we moved it to April in recognition. April is Second Chance Month, So we decided that we'll do that annually. And so I continue to serve with them and to help those that, you know, and everybody is not interested in that. So we want the folks that is not a party. When we come here, it's about renewal. It's about restoration. It's about uplifting. You know, and I always like to use my favorite quote, because I'm just a vessel,
yeah,
right? That I always say, to whom much is given, much is required. And I know God has given me more than I deserve. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm obligated to give back, and particularly to give back to the underserved and marginalized populations, because I've been there. I know what it's like to be there, and I'm so honored to serve, and I take that responsibility very, very seriously. So I'm just grateful for all the things that God has given to me, and I feel like I as long as I can breathe, I'm going to continue to serve.
That's beautiful.
And serve those of us.
Beautiful, man. Beautiful. When you leave the earth, which will probably be another 150 years, what would you like to be remembered for?
I you know, I want to be remembered as a good son, father, and community leader that never really put self first, and just wanted to serve. You know, serve and make life better for those that ever enter my circle.
Mm-hmm. That's great, man. I tell you the truth. I want to thank you, Lord. I thank you, man, for carving out the time today, Carlisle. I know you're a very busy man. It's hard to catch up with you sometimes, but you're taking the time to be with us today, and I'm quite sure that the audience who will be listening to your life story will be radically benefited by it. And again, I hope this is not the last time that you'll be with us. I hope that you will find the time to be with us on more occasions, talking about other things that are important to you.
Well, I thank you for the opportunity. And again, I want to wish you much success on your radio program. And I appreciate the opportunity to share my personal life story, and it's just really a snippet of what, you know, we can probably have a whole series, you know, about some of the my whole life journey. But I'm blessed and consider it a high honor that you will consider to interview me for your radio program.
Yeah, well, I want you to know, so that I can tell there's so much more in you. So again, we'll have the opportunity of coming again and sharing more of highlights, special points that will be a benefit to others. Okay, again, I thank you, my brother, and give your family my love until we meet again.
Okay, thank you, Pastor, and God bless you as well.
Same to you. Bye-bye.